It is Friday, November 13th, Universal Time, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Michael Lippin in Washington. In the next half hour, we'll speak to our Pentagon correspondent for the latest on the U.S. military's targeting of Jihadi John. We'll hear from our State Department correspondent on John Kerry's meetings in Vienna to try to resolve Syria's conflict. And I'll speak with a daughter of a Hong Kong publisher who is critical of China and who has also gone missing. All that ahead on International Edition. The U.S. military says it has carried out an airstrike targeting Jihadi John, a notorious British Islamic State militant who appeared in several videos depicting the murder of Western hostages. For the latest on that story, we're joined now on the line by our Pentagon correspondent, Carla Babb. Carla, what can you tell us about the U.S. Position on the status of Jihadi John?
Well, I literally just walked out of a briefing with Colonel Steve Warren talking to us from the Pentagon, from Baghdad, I should say, and he said that the United States is, quote, reasonably certain that they killed their intended target. He explained that Jihadi John was in a car with one other person. He jokingly referred to him as the worst best friend because Jihadi John got him killed as well, and he said that both of the people in the vehicle were reasonably certain that they were killed.
Well, what would be the significance of the U.S. taking out this militant? Have there been other such strikes on top ISIS militants lately?
Yes, I actually asked that question to Colonel Warren minutes ago, and he said that the death of Jihadi John was actually more significant for the Islamic State. He said, for the United States, this was routine. For the Islamic State, Jihadi John was a major recruitment tool. He was a human animal, he said, and having him out makes the world a better place, according to Colonel Warren. But for the United States, keep in mind, there's been one mid to upper level Islamic State leader killed by the U.S. and coalition forces every other day since May started. So you can imagine this is something that they do all the time. So the strike on this car in Raqqa was routine, but for the families of all of those beheaded and seen in all of those videos, this was a very significant hit.
And how concerned are the people at the Pentagon that other militants would just rise up, take the places of those killed?
Well, the Pentagon's not going to speculate. The Pentagon has said before that's the thing that happens with the Islamic State. When one person is killed, another one will rise up. But then Colonel Warren has said this earlier this month, you know, we take out that person too, he says. Mm-hmm. He goes, he was talking about a city in Syria where they killed the first leader of the Islamic State, then he was replaced, then they killed him, then there was a third one, and they had him targeted. So it was just a matter of time. So I think that the United States is trying to stress that this is a significant blow in the way that it's making the Islamic State go into their next level leaders instead of their fresh, you know, honed on the battlefield leaders. It's pulling up the young people. They've been having child soldiers go in, and so they're kind of drawing at straws and starting to get weaker.
Well, if I can also ask you just briefly, what is the latest from the Pentagon on the status of the Iraqi town of Sinjar?
The Pentagon is very proud of what's happening in Sinjar. Colonel Warren said that the Kurds had seized and were in the process of clearing Sinjar. The United States provided 250 coalition airstrikes in the last 30 days to help, and there are U.S. service members embedded, helping, advising, and assisting some of the Kurds that are on top of that mountain as they're selecting their strikes so they can assure that normal partners are not going to be targeted in any of these strikes. It's still a process. Colonel Warren said that, yes, while it's been seized, it's going to take a week, maybe even up to 2 weeks, to completely clear the area of Islamic State militants, but they are hopeful that that will be done as soon as possible.
Okay. Well, thank you very much to our Pentagon correspondent, Carla Babb, for that report.
Thank you for having me.
Well, the fate of Jihadi John has been a big topic on social media today, and we've got Charlie Hansler here in the studio to tell us more about it. So, Charlie, what are people saying today about Jihadi John?
Well, most people on Twitter searching for news and information on the topic seem to just be typing in the term, two words, Jihadi John, without using a major hashtag of any kind. The social media analytics site Topsy.com found the two words, Jihadi John, were used over 4,000 times the past hour. CNN's Piers Morgan tweeted from his Twitter handle, @PiersMorgan, about an upcoming article he plans to write on Jihadi John. "My new @DailyMail column is about Jihadi John, posting soon," he tweeted. Meanwhile, the New York Times' global news Twitter handle, @NYTimesWorld, tweeted a look back at statements by Jihadi John with a link to an article that has some of Jihadi John's most famous statements, including his infamous statement when he called U.S. President Barack Obama, quote, "the dog of Rome," end quote.
That could be his famous last words right there. So what else is popular on Twitter today?
Well, it's Friday the 13th, so people are really going crazy about that on Twitter. Just the three words, Friday the 13th, is very popular. The phrase has been used in tweets over 27,000 times in the past hour, according to Topsy.com. Most people mention the popular horror movie of the same name, and others talk about the superstitious aspect of the infamous date. It's important to note that the Friday the 13th phenomenon is not restricted to English speakers, because the hashtag Viernes13 is also extremely popular on Twitter, and Viernes is the Spanish word for Friday.
Nice to see that tradition is spreading beyond America. Thanks very much, Charlie Hansler, for that update.
Okay, sure, thanks.
U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry has just arrived in Vienna, Austria, for his second meeting in recent weeks on finding a political solution to Syria's conflict. Well, earlier I spoke to our State Department correspondent Pam Dawkins, who is in Vienna, and I asked her what Kerry hopes to achieve from the talks.
Well, Kerry and the other world powers who are gathering here for talks hope to push forward the initial round of talks about a week and a half ago, looking at Syria's political future. This meeting will include Iran, Russia, and Saudi Arabia. They are part of a group of 17 countries plus the UN and EU, and this time around the Arab League. Kerry has some bilateral meetings this evening, and the talks get into full swing tomorrow. One interesting aspect of this round of talks is that several world powers have floated the idea of coming up with some sort of formal agreement on which organizations in the Syrian opposition are terror groups and those which are part of the moderate opposition, with, of course, the goal being down the road to bring the players with the moderate opposition to the bargaining table.
Well, who are those players who have made those suggestions, and what is the opinion of the U.S. on that idea?
Well, there is no agreement at this point on which groups are considered terrorist groups and which ones are part of the moderate opposition. Different countries have different views, and it partly falls into line with their alignment. Of course, Russia and Iran are more closely aligned with the Syrian regime, which has different ideas about which groups should be part of the bargaining process. It's one of the obstacles that players hope to iron out, if not in this round of talks, certainly in the near future, so that the moderate opposition, once designated, can be part of these negotiations.
Well, what can you tell us about what John Kerry discussed earlier in his meetings with the Tunisian leaders in Tunis?
Yes, Secretary Kerry was in Tunis for the second U.S. strategic dialogue. The first one took place a year ago. He said the eyes of the world are on Tunisia. This, of course, is a country that has been praised by the U.S. for its democratic reforms since the 2011 Arab Spring. But at the same time, Tunisia is suffering from some economic slowdown, brought on largely as a result of two terrorist attacks earlier this year, one at a museum and one at a hotel. Since then, the tourism industry has slowed significantly, and tourism is a major part of Tunisia's economy. Tunisia is also dealing with border security, in particular its border with Libya. There's concern about the Libyan unrest, militant unrest, spilling over more into Tunisia. It was something that the Tunisian foreign minister addressed in a joint appearance with Secretary Kerry today. He asked for more U.S. assistance in protecting the border. Kerry also mentioned concerns about unrest in neighboring Libya. The United States has already given Tunisia about $700 million since 2011, and today Kerry announced some initial plans to move forward, which would be the third U.S. loan guarantee to Tunisia to help it with stabilization and efforts to continue building its democracy.
Well, thank you very much to our State Department correspondent Pam Dawkins with John Kerry in Vienna for that update.
Thank you.
This is VOA.
This is BizBeat.
Business had been picking up for the past several years at the Red Sea resort town of Sharm el-Sheikh. That's until a Russian passenger plane crashed in October. Since then, hotel operators and businesses have seen revenues plummet.
Before the incident, we were at about 92% occupancy, guests in house, doing quite well. Now here we are a week later, we're at 60% occupancy.
Basil Kader manages the Sultan's Gardens Hotel, employing more than 500 people. He says the decision by the UK and Russia to suspend flights to the area is having a domino effect on other industries, which indirectly rely on the tourist trade.
It's about all the staff or all the people who support the tourism industry indirectly, whether they be suppliers, transportation, insurance companies, you name it.
Tourism accounts for 6% of Egypt's economy, and last year, Russians and Britons made up 2/3 of Egypt's 3 million visitors. For VOA's BizBeat, I'm Philip Alexio.
I'm Michael Lippin with VOA's International Edition. A Hong Kong publisher has gone missing while on a visit to Thailand. Gui Min Hai owns a company that runs a Hong Kong bookstore selling publications that are highly critical of the Chinese government. Colleagues of Gui say they suspect he and several associates were detained in Thailand by Chinese agents 2 weeks ago. Earlier, I spoke to Gui's daughter, who lives in England, and I asked her what she knows about her father's situation.
I don't know that much more than what I've read in the media. I wasn't aware of his sort of official status as missing until 3 days ago, where I was contacted by his business partner in Hong Kong by email. And then after that, it started popping up in the media, and I started reading news about it. Because before, I mean, I obviously knew that he hadn't been contactable, because I'd been trying to reach him for over 2 weeks before he disappeared, or before I was told that he disappeared. But I just assumed that he was busy, or that something had happened to his phone, or something like that.
Do you know if he had been in contact with any other members of your family or friends?
I don't, but I actually received a very odd message from him this morning, where he told me that he had transferred money to my bank account and that he hoped I would be fine. But he didn't tell me where he was, and I hadn't asked him about money or anything. I mean, when we last spoke, which was on the 13th of October, we only talked about sort of my university education and what I was going to do next, as I'm graduating next year. And that kind of thing. And he said that he would get back to me, or that he would call me and that we could talk about it again in the following week. So I hadn't asked him for money or anything at all.
Well, what do you make of that message? How do you interpret it?
I have no idea. I mean, it's sort of a relief in a way, because I know that that means he's still alive. But it's just really strange.
Did you have any suspicion or feeling that he might get in trouble of some kind because of the sensitive work that he's been doing in Hong Kong, running a bookstore that sells books that are highly critical of the Chinese government?
I have been a little bit worried, yes, but he's not really wanted to talk to me about it. So I just assumed that he knew what he was doing.
Have you been seeking any help or support from anyone to try to establish where your father is?
I've obviously been in contact with the Swedish Ministry of Foreign Affairs, and from what I understand, they're working on it. They've got a designated person to work on the case, and they're keeping me updated as they're getting more information. But right now, there's not many people that I've been talking to now.
Well, what do you expect to happen next? What do you think is going to happen next?
I have no idea. I'm just hoping that the Swedish authorities, in cooperation with the Thai and perhaps Hong Kong or Chinese authorities, will be able to find something out and establish where he is.
Well, thank you very much for speaking with us. We'll certainly follow this case as it proceeds and wish you well.
Right. Thank you.
Myanmar's opposition National League for Democracy has captured an absolute majority of parliamentary seats in the country's recent election. Our Southeast Asia bureau chief, Steve Herman, has been following the results from Bangkok. I spoke to him today via Skype and asked him what the victorious NLD plans to do next.
Well, according to party officials, what its leader Aung San Suu Kyi wants to do next is to have a meeting of what they're calling national reconciliation with President Thein Sein and the army chief. And all indications are that meeting will happen and will probably be held next week.
Well, what are the prospects for a genuine reconciliation process between the military-backed government and the opposition?
Well, there are a lot of things that need to be done. The NLD is certainly going to want to move to have political prisoners released. Eventually, what they're going to want to do is to take out the military's automatic holding of 25% of the parliamentary seats. And another constitutional change, of course, would be to get rid of this clause that the then ruling military junta put in that specifically bars, not by name, but essentially bars Aung San Suu Kyi from becoming president because her sons are citizens of a foreign country.
Well, just quickly, how easy would it be for the NLD, once a new government is put in place, to actually change that constitution?
Well, theoretically, considering that they're going to hold about 80% of the seats in both the lower house and the upper house, that would give them a way to neutralize the military's automatic veto in the bicameral 664-seat legislature. So they will have the legislative clout to do this. They'll presumably have executive power, and it just remains to be seen how quickly the military is going to want to go along with any such significant reforms, as well as how extensive they're going to be willing to accommodate this. But so far, everything looks very good for the NLD because, unlike 1990, the last time Aung San Suu Kyi's party won, the military is saying it's going to abide by the outcome of this democratic exercise and not move in and bar the opposition from taking power.
That was our Southeast Asia bureau chief, Steve Herman, speaking with me earlier from Bangkok via Skype. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
Lying beneath Yellowstone National Park is one of the world's biggest potential supervolcanoes. If the enormous volcano should ever completely blow its top, some scientists say that the eruption could devastate parts of the U.S. and impact the world's climate for several years. But the U.S. National Geological Survey says a super eruption at Yellowstone is unlikely to occur within the next 1,000 or even 10,000 years. Scientists have thought that volcanoes erupt when pressure inside its magma chamber builds to a point where it causes an explosion, which triggers an eruption. But a new study finds that supervolcano eruptions might actually be triggered by external mechanisms, such as when the roof above its magma chamber cracks or collapses. The study's lead scientist, Patricia Gregg of the University of Illinois, says that if we want to determine if a supervolcano is about to erupt, then a better understanding of what triggers a super eruption is needed. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Now for a look at the entertainment world. The new movie Trumbo by filmmaker Jay Roach tells the story of Dalton Trumbo, the highest paid American screenwriter in 1950s Hollywood. Trumbo's career came to a halt when he and other Hollywood artists were blacklisted by a congressional committee because they refused to testify about their political convictions. Breaking Bad star Bryan Cranston plays the part of Trumbo, who faced his predicament with a shrewdness that helped to bring an end to the witch hunt in Tinseltown. VOA's Penelope Pulu has more.
Are you not, or have you ever been a member of the Communist Party?
Many questions can be answered yes or no only by a moron or a slave.
Bryan Cranston says the message of the story attracted him to the role more so than Trumbo's flamboyant character.
This man who was a prolific writer, the highest paid screenwriter in Hollywood at the time, and a member of the American Communist Party, and summoned to Washington to make a statement under oath, under the penalty of imprisonment, to withgo his First Amendment rights and be compelled to give testimony with a very un-American question: are you now or have you ever been a member of the Communist Party? And freedoms that civil liberties that were granted to the citizenry by the forefathers that fought long and hard to create that as a foundation of America.
You talk like a radical, but you live like a rich guy.
It's like a perfect combination. The radical may fight the purity of Jesus, but the rich guy wins with the cunning of Satan.
Trumbo's acerbic wit doesn't win him any friends. In 1950, he is sentenced for contempt of court. He is no longer allowed to work in Hollywood and loses his wealth. But he's talented and resourceful.
All right. I'll write you a movie for $1,200, then.
And you don't want your name on it?
No, you don't want my name on it.
Gossip columnist and fervent anti-communist Hedda Hopper, played by Helen Mirren, is one of Trumbo's greatest foes. She has vowed to wipe him off the face of Hollywood.
Come on, rub my face in it. Whisper a movie you've written in secret. Maybe I've even heard of it.
She wasn't far off. Trumbo won 2 Academy Awards under different names. His talent helped chip away at the injustice of the blacklist and silenced his enemies. Jay Roach's witty satire and stellar cast does more than entertain. It offers a stark reminder of what happens when political bullying goes unchecked and civil liberties are chipped away. Penelope Pulu, VOA News, Washington.
And you've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. Your director today was Patrice Martin, and the engineer was Peter Hunley. I'm Michael Lippin in Washington. I'd love to hear from you on Twitter. You can find me there at Michael_Lippin. The show is there, too. We're at VOA_IE. Have a great weekend.
Next, an international public service announcement by the United States government.
Saif al-Adel is a fugitive and suspected high-ranking member of the Al-Qaeda terror network who was wanted in connection with the 1998 bombings of the U.S. embassies in Dar es Salaam, Tanzania, and Nairobi, Kenya. He is an Egyptian citizen with black hair and dark eyes. He is also believed to be affiliated with the Egyptian Islamic Jihad. He is also known as Ibrahim al-Madani and Muhammad Ibrahim Makawi. Hundreds of people were killed in the embassy attacks and thousands wounded, most Kenyan and Tanzanian citizens. 12 Americans died. For these and other acts, al-Adel is charged with murder, conspiracy to destroy United States property, and other crimes. The Rewards for Justice program is offering a reward of up to $5 million for information leading to al-Adel's arrest or prosecution. The U.S. guarantees that all reports will be investigated and the identity of all informants will be kept confidential. If appropriate, the U.S. is prepared to protect informants by relocating them. If you have information on this man, contact the Regional Security Office at the nearest U.S. embassy and the tip line at www.rewardsforjustice.net or email information to rfj@state.gov.
That was an international public service announcement by the United States government.